Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Thank you. My name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
My sobriety date is March the 5th, 1991. And when I say that I'm an alcoholic, for me, I'm going to qualify it with the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. It's on my iPad here, and the way that I qualify myself as an alcoholic is from the Big Book, because the Big Book had a tremendous impact on my life. The Big Book changed my life. And when I say I'm an alcoholic, I'm the alcoholic as described on page 21. And on page 21 it says, "Here's the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredible, tragic things while drinking. He's a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde." When I read this and I started putting everything together, I started to look back over my life. And I started to really identify with these passages, because some of them were true and some of them weren't. Some of them were imagined in my mind and some of them weren't. I mean, to think that I was a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The problem was, is I had become Mr. Hyde and Mr. Hyde. But in my head, I was still capable of such wonderful things. But it did not balance with the way that I was living. And what happened was I increasingly became unable to live with myself. And increasingly became more and more, I'd say, ashamed at what I had become. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 26 years old. I really considered myself a failure. And one of the reasons was because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't want to stop drinking. You know, I wanted to continue drinking. I started my sobriety in Tampa, and I remember going to the 545 there at night. And there was a gentleman who came in, and we both basically walked in the door the same night. And he was about 44 years old, and I was honestly jealous of him, because I thought, wow, he got to enjoy so many more good years of drinking. And I had to drag my sorry butt in here when I was only 26. Yeah. And it comes back to one of the things that's really the key to a lot of my drinking and a lot of my life, my early life. And that is, in here, one of the words that really sticks out to me is the word is absurd. So many things that I did were absurd. So many things that I believed were just absurd. So many things I hang on to, they're just absurd. The idea that today I could have some kind of fear of economic insecurity or anything, it's absurd. I stand before you, I'm 48 years old, I can honestly say I've never been hungry a day in my life. Never. I consider myself the genetic lottery winner. I was born a white man in America in 1964. I had a lot of stuff going for me, just coming right out of the chute. I grew up in Sharon, Massachusetts, 30 miles south of Boston. I grew up one of the education capitals of the world. I grew up with great school systems. I grew up in a great family. Two brothers, two sisters. I would seemingly seem to have it all. And the problem is I had developed a situation where I didn't want any of it. And I felt slighted. And I could only see things from my perspective. And one of the things that happens to me is once I take a drink, I lose the ability to see your point of view. Okay? I just don't see it. All I see is what's happening to me, how everything affects me. Now, this is something when I got to AA, I had to seriously take a look at. And the idea of selfishness. The selfishness that I went through is overwhelmingly absurd. You know, the idea that I think I'm not going to get what I want or not going to get what I think I need is crazy. You know, my needs were always met. My needs have always been met. I live a very, very comfortable life. And when fears come into my life, I never had anything to deal with them when I was younger. All I did was drink. You know, I went through the death of my grandparents and everything. Drunk. All the time. And Dan and I have discussed this in the past, and that is, and you'll hear it sometimes, and that was, I just stopped developing emotionally. And I just didn't have any emotional development. And once I started drinking, I could no longer handle things. I never had to. I never knew what it felt like to feel grief. You know, the idea that somehow I could escape it in a bottle was crazy. You know, but that's what I tried to do. I tried to live my life without feelings. Yeah. And here it says he is seldom mildly intoxicated. He's always more or less insanely drunk. I drank to get drunk. I had no illusions. I mean, for me, it goes back to even when I was a kid. I was 11 years old, and I remember I would babysit the little kid who lived next door to us. And I was a really good kid. I mean, I was a really good kid, straight A student. I mean, I was a wonderful little boy. Yeah, so much so that neighbors would leave their children on me. Yeah, and I remember going over to his house. I remember at his house they had apple juice, and my family didn't buy apple juice. And I remember pouring the apple juice in a glass. And I was 11 years old and thinking, you know what, when I get older, this is going to be whiskey. That's a crazy thought for an 11-year-old to have. But that's what I had. And then when I became older, it was whiskey. Yeah, but I loved the idea of drinking. I loved romancing the drink. I loved everything about drinking, yeah. And I was very seldomly mildly intoxicated. I mean, I didn't do cocaine because it woke me up. I did LSD because it took me out. That was the point of my using. That was the way I drank. And that's even my mom would say, Eric just drinks till it's gone. Yeah. And that was the way I drank from the very beginning. When I was 12 years old, I was in the hospital for acute alcohol poisoning. For drinking basically a fifth of vodka in 20 minutes. Yeah. Some wonderful soul actually revived me and gave me mouth-to-mouth, covered in puke. Yeah. I'm the lottery winner. Well, I've had so many good things happen in my life. So you think I would never drink again? No, that's not what happened to me. I just started smoking pot. And then started drinking again when I was a little bit older. You know, the idea that I would, you know, that I would stay away from it, that was just silly. You know, it just never even occurred to me through my whole drinking career. I never considered stopping. I never tried to quit. I never tried to quit and fail. I never tried to quit. I never wanted to try to quit drinking. You know, his disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day and he frequently becomes disgustingly and dangerously antisocial. And I think this is one of the lies I told myself, that I was a wonderful fellow except for this drinking thing. And that's not the way it was. That's not the truth of the way it was. You know, what happened to me was my value system and my ability to withstand things like going to jail kept floating lower and lower and lower and lower. And the price of my drinking got higher and higher, and I was always willing to pay it. I went to jail many times when I was a teenager and in my early 20s. It never bothered me. I considered it inconvenient. But I have this wonderful chameleon-like ability where I can get along anywhere. You know? So I was in jail for 90 days. Just sucks. But I was a ping-pong champion, man. You know? I mean, I made it work. You know? And when I went to jail, I didn't bitch about it. I didn't get lawyers, and I didn't try to get out of it. You know, it was just the price of my drinking, and I was willing to pay it. I paid it gladly. I had 4 DUIs. I had my first DUI 3 years before I ever had a driver's license. You know? And the only reason why I didn't get a driver's license until I was 18 was because my parents wouldn't sign off. They said, there's no way we're going to give you a license to go drive a car. You know, I was 15, I was arrested for DWI. Driving to endanger, destruction of property, and use without authority. And use without authority is a fancy way of saying stealing your father's truck. Yeah, because it was my dad's, it wasn't stolen. I used it without authority, and my parents were on vacation. That was when I was 15 years old. I started going through that. And the first time I went through it, my parents shelled out a lot of money for a lawyer. And the second time I went through it, they shelled out less money for a lawyer. And by the third time, they didn't shell out any money for a lawyer. Yeah. I began to believe I was an alcoholic sometime around 18. And it's because so many people had told me, you're an alcoholic. Because of the DUI thing, when I was 15, I had to go to AA when I was 16 years old. I was sentenced to AA. Yeah. And that's another thing that I think is absolutely absurd. I mean, in our preamble, we say we're a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope. And the thing is AA is not allied with any related facilities, or I know I'm paraphrasing, But the funny thing is AA is not allied with the court system, but for some reason the court system's allied with us. You know? And I have a little bit of a problem with that, because to me it sounds crazy to sentence people to go to AA. You know, to say to them, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and give them a paper to sign. That sounds just silly. But the problem is I'm standing before you and it worked for me. Because I did have to go to AA meetings. Okay? I didn't hear a word of it. Did not hear a single word of it. I went to a 12-step meeting every Monday night and got my paper signed for a year. And when I checked into Charter Hospital 3 years later, I read the steps for the first time in my life. I went to that meeting and just tried to figure out, all right, how long is this going to take? When can I get out of here? And I was one of those people who stopped at the liquor store on the way home. Yeah. But the thing was, is the one thing it did do for me was I was able to see that there was a group of men and women smiling and laughing that didn't drink. And that's what it really did for me. It gave me an idea that, you know what? There is a place I can go. I didn't want to go. I didn't want to be one of you guys. I had such bigger plans for myself than to be an alcoholic. I mean, I looked at you guys when I was sentenced to AA and thought, what a nice bunch. That AA thing really works well for them. God bless them. You know, God bless them. But I wasn't one of you. You know? And one of the reasons was because I just didn't want to stop drinking. And I've got this absolute belief that the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous is simply written in code. And the code breaker is the desire to stop drinking. And if you don't have the desire to stop drinking, it's just a book. They're just words. It's like reading The Great Gatsby. But if you have the desire to stop drinking, it changes its meaning completely. And once you get into it, then you find out that it kind of changes its meaning every time that you read it. You know? He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment, particularly when some important decision must be made or engagement kept. My first DUI was when I was 15 and I went to court with my parents. After that, I went by myself, and every time I went, I was completely hungover. And every night before I went there, I said to myself, you got to go to court in the morning, Eric. Don't get loaded tonight. Every night I was up till 4 o'clock in the morning. Every time I stood before a judge, I was pickled. Really pickled. The last DUI I got when I was 23, I knew I was going to lose my license because that was in 1987. And they had really started to come down on drunk driving laws at that time. And I knew I was going to lose my license for a long time. So my plan was, as I was going to drive to the courthouse and park at the Cumberland Farms down the street, call a taxi and have a taxi take me to the courthouse, go surrender my license, take the taxi back to my truck and drive home. Because the last time I had went, I was loaded and my ex-wife refused to go with me and then refused to pick me up and I had to hitchhike home and that wasn't going to happen again. I can learn a lesson. And, what happened was I got so loaded that I was late for court, so I had to drive my truck right into the parking lot of the court, and I went into the parking lot of the court, surrendered my license, and then had to get in my car and drive home after just handing them my license. Yeah. And that's just absurd. It's just crazy to live like that. You know? But to me, somehow, this all made sense. But I was beginning to notice now that I was really getting pickled. I was really just starting to smell like alcohol all the time, because that's what I did. It came out of my pores. You know, I was nice enough to meet a nice little Al-Anon who was kind enough to marry me and figure that someday she would fix me. And that never happened. What happened instead was I ended up in AA. You know, and how I ended up in AA was through the Charter Hospital of Behavioral Sciences. And it used to be over on what we used to call Buffalo. Okay. And I went there because I happened to have one thing I could always do was I could hold a job. I could always hold a job. I was a union bricklayer at the time, and I had good insurance. And I worked on a crew where there was 11 of us, and 7 were from Michigan, and 4 of us were from Massachusetts, and every one of us was a really heavy hitter. And the only rule was, you just show up for work. Doesn't matter how you can show up drunk, but it's a union job, so you show up. And that's what we did. You know, as we all covered for each other and everything, and then when I decided that I was, uh, uh, I just just couldn't take it anymore and I needed to go to treatment. I had really good insurance and I was able to go to a nice cushy hospital for 21 days. And Charter Hospital of Behavioral Sciences over on what used to be Buffalo was an amazing experience for me. It was a truly amazing experience for me. The way that my breakdown happened was about 90 days before I went into the hospital, I just couldn't stand living anymore. I was really getting suicidal, and I decided that for the first time in my life, I was going to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist and tell the truth. I had never done that. I had made trips back and forth to the psychologist. Hell, I sat there with my parents. I remember one time I went with my parents, and they let me meet with the doctor for an hour before my parents got there, and then my parents came in, and by the time my parents were there for 15 minutes, the doctor had convinced my parents that they were wrong, and that they should leave me alone, and that I shouldn't really be forced to take the trash out, and that they just didn't understand me. I was like some kind of misunderstood genius. Yeah, and my genius was getting you to see my point of view without having to see yours, to get what I wanted from you. Yeah, and that's what I was really good at. Yeah. And so when I was having my breakdown, and I went to the doctor, and I told him I can't take it anymore, I can't sleep, I can't do anything, because what had happened was I understood how the physical functions of addiction worked. I understood that if you eat anything every day for a decade, your body's going to synthesize it. Your body's going to develop a dependency on it. It basically works with almost anything. Now, I understood how it worked with alcohol. And I knew that I would become physically addicted to alcohol. I ran with heavy hitters. I ran with guys who got the shakes. I ran with guys. I'd seen the DTs. But the thing that I thought was, of all the things for me to be addicted to, alcohol wasn't a bad one. I loved it. I loved to drink. So I knew what I had coming down to me. You know, I drank every day. You know, so the idea of being hooked on alcohol, that didn't sound very frightening to me. But what I didn't know was that I would reach a point where I'd want to stop and then couldn't. That's the part I didn't count on. I thought I'd still be having fun. I really thought I'd still be having fun. And what happened to me was I started developing terrible anxiety and panic attacks. And it started on a daily basis. And as the panic attacks would happen, and if you've ever had them, you kind of sit there waiting for it to happen. That's what good times are like. Waiting for the panic attack. And when it hits, it's awful. I mean, it's terrible. And I started to live with them every day on a daily basis, you know. And what I also started doing was I started, my ex-wife, one of the things I used to do was, we didn't go to bed together anymore. She'd usually go to bed, and then I'd go to bed about an hour later. And what I used to do was I'd always open a beer and put it on my nightstand. And my ex-wife used to think that I would drink it before I fell asleep. And she didn't know that I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd be DTing. And I'd have to drink it just to be able to get back to sleep for two more hours. Yeah. And that's the way I lived. And when I went to this doctor, he decided that my solution would be Xanax. And he gave me a prescription for Xanax and allowed me to get back and forth to work so that I wouldn't have to drink 24 hours a day. So I would take Xanax when I got up in the morning, and I would start drinking around noon with the other bricklayers. And what happened was I just stopped eating. And I lost about 30 pounds in 90 days. When I checked into Charter Hospital, I was about 142 pounds, a complete physical wreck. Now, my ex-wife had enough of me, and that was okay. I mean, that was okay with me. We'd had a lot of bad scenes and everything, and we had tried, but it wasn't working. I had a job I didn't want, an apartment I didn't want, a car I didn't want, and a wife I didn't want. Yeah. And then she did something that I hadn't counted on, and that is she called my parents. And my parents were the ones I could not face. When my parents came knocking on my door as I was sitting in my apartment, because I hadn't left for 2 days because I was shaking so bad, but I was going to be running out of booze, so I was going to have to leave. And when I heard my mom's voice on the other side of the door, and that was the thing that I could not handle, was having to look into my mother's eyes and say, this is what I've become. All the advantages I had, and this is what I've become. Yeah. And so my parents and I, little snot that I was, though, what I did was I then drove around town and interviewed behavioral science hospitals. I went out to what is that one of the Humana Hospital over there, and for Memorial. I went out there. I went a couple of other places, and then I decided I'd go to Charter Hospital because they had a basketball court. And that's what sold me. Yeah. And I remember when we left there, they said to my parents, it's not a good idea for you to leave. We find it best if you usually leave the person. And my mother looked right at him and said, oh no, if my son said he'll be back tomorrow, he'll come back tomorrow. I mean, even at that point, she still believed in me. Yeah. And that's what I couldn't handle the most, was having to look into my parents' eyes. You know, because they knew what I had been through. And they also had gone through it with me. Yeah. I mean, they seemed to have felt everything that I had felt. And I never really was able to relate to them. I went for a period with my mom for about 5 years where we could not talk without having an argument. Just couldn't talk. Yeah. And that continued even after I was sober. Yeah. But then, and I'm going to continue on this list and I'll flash back to it. And that is, he's often perfectly sensible and well-balanced in everything except liquor. But in that respect, he's incredibly dishonest and selfish. Yeah. I mean, for me, that was another lie I told myself when I read this. But you know what? I'm a hell of a guy, except for this liquor thing again. You know, otherwise, I'm completely trustworthy. You know, he often possesses special abilities, skills, and aptitudes, and has a promising career ahead of him. He uses his gifts to build up a bright outlook for his family and himself, and then pulls the structure down on his head by a senseless series of sprees. And that was me to a T, you know? I mean, basically, like I had said, I mean, I was born into abundance. I was born with advantages. I could have gone to basically any school I wanted to go to on the track I was on. Then I started smoking dope and everything went bad. You know? But in my head, I could still be anything. In my ego, I could still be anything. You know? So I could read this stuff and think, you know what? This is really starting to apply to me. He is the fellow who goes to bed so intoxicated he ought to sleep the clock around. And I did that many, many times. Yet in the morning he searches madly for the bottle he misplaced the night before. And then it says, then comes the day he simply can't take it and gets drunk again all over again. Perhaps he goes to a doctor who gives him morphine or some sedative for which to taper off, and then he begins to appear at hospitals and sanitariums. And that was me with my Xanax and my Charter Hospital. Now here's the one thing though. The first sentence I read in that paragraph, it says, here's the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. I had read through this book a couple of times when I was in Charter Hospital, and I was getting out of Charter Hospital, and we were going through our group therapy and everything. And I remember this, and I was reading this book, and it says, here's the fellow who's been puzzling you. And I said in my head, in my inner monologue, I had said, I tell you what, dude, you're the fellow who's puzzling you. Because I thought, who's the fellow who's puzzling me? And it was me. And I went, oh my God, here's the fellow who's been puzzling you. Reread it as, here is you. And that's when I reread it as, here is you. Because now I had the desire to stop drinking. And for the first time in my life, I really, truly started to identify with the words in this book. And I started to get honest with myself and reread that whole paragraph and said, wow, again and again and again, this is me. This is me. Yeah. And in the 21 days that I spent in Charter Hospital, I was in there. And I remember... my third day there, my parents had taken a motel. At the time they lived over in Orlando, there were snowbirds, and they'd take a motel in Tampa, and they were staying in a motel while I was in the hospital. And I remember on the third day when I had stabilized enough to be able to walk outside of my immediate ward, because I wasn't shaking anymore, they said, you can go to an AA meeting. And my parents used to come in every night at 5:30 to have dinner with us. We had dinner from 5:30 to 6:30. And they had an AA meeting at 7:15. And so my parents came down and they had dinner with me. And we sat there and we ate and we went back to the addictive disease ward, the ADU, where we hung out, me and 21 of my buddies. And I remember I was sitting there and my parents were like, oh, we're going to go to the meeting with you tonight. And I'm thinking, I don't want you to go to the meeting with me tonight. You know, and they're like, oh, no, we'll wait. We'll go to the meeting with you tonight. And I'm thinking, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, if you were such wonderful parents, I wouldn't be so screwed up. Why would I want you there? Same thing with my ex-wife. She used to come visit me every day, and I used to think, just please God, let her stop at someone else's table. Every time she walks in, she walks right to my table and sits down across from me, and I wish she would just stop on the way and sit down and talk to someone else. Because it all was about you guys. You guys had done this to me. I had this done to me. You know? And my parents sat there, and they were talking, and we were sitting there back at the ward, and I remember I said to my father, I said, Dad, the meeting's not for another 45 minutes. You don't really need to hang around for 45 minutes waiting for this meeting. You know? And my father looked at me, and he said, son, I've waited 12 years to go to this meeting. Another 45 minutes isn't going to bother me. And I got to see, really, how it had affected him. What it really did to him. And then my mother started arguing, no, he's been a drunk for 14 years. And then I thought, see? This is why I'm so screwed up. They can't even agree on how long I've been a drunk. Yeah. And as they sat there bickering, though. But that's one of those things that you really hold on to. Yeah. And especially fathers and sons have special relationships sometimes. And me and my dad, we didn't hardly ever talk. Yeah. We didn't talk much. We talked about the Red Sox. Talked about the Patriots. Yeah. I mean, we'd sit in the same room and read the newspaper and drink coffee together. But we didn't need to talk. Yeah. But he came through for me every time that he could. I mean, the idea of how painful it must have been for him. Because I heard him when I was in jail, talking to the police officers, and them having to talk him into leaving me. Yeah. And they'd say, hey, Mr. Johnson, there's no reason for you to take him home. Let him sit here. Yeah. You can take him home, you can drive him to court Monday morning, or you can just let him sit here for the weekend. Yeah. And my father going, okay, all right, fine. Yeah. But the thing was, is he still came. He still came. Yeah. And he stuck by me. He really, I did not know what was possible with that until I had a son of my own. You know? And I think it's perfectly wonderful. I have a 13-year-old son, and some of you in the room know him. And to be able to stand in front of you tonight and say, my son's never seen me take a drink. You know? That is absolutely amazing. I mean, that is amazing. Yeah. My son and I have a wonderful relationship today. You know? As he's becoming a man, I was talking about it last week with Dan, and I don't know what waits around the corner for us and what's going to happen in the next several years. Quite honestly, I'm quite scared. Yeah. Alcoholism hit my family really hard. Both of my brothers are heavy hitters, and both of my sisters married heavy hitters. Yeah. Now, my parents weren't. I've saw my father drunk one time in my whole life. Yeah. I mean, my father got home every night and he'd have a beer, and I think that was just because somehow he thought that's what fathers do, to get home and have a beer. But he never drank to get drunk. I saw him drunk one time, you know. But man, did it rip through his kids. Did it rip through his kids. And I see my sister's kids and my you know, they struggle. They really struggle with addiction and with things. And, you know, I hoped it would skip a generation, you know. But I see it in my son, and I think the best thing I can do is, keep talking with him. I mean, up until 2 years ago when my ex and I split, my son knew nothing of my alcoholism because I did not bring AA into my home. And I tried to bring the principles into my home, but I was not open with my family about my alcoholism. We didn't talk about it much. It was just simply called my allergy. That's all my son knew it as, was Daddy's allergy. You know, and that's how it was explained to him. It was explained to him in the simplest terms that a child could understand. You know, which was some people are allergic to amoxicillin. I happen to be allergic to alcohol, and that's why we don't have any. And that's why you don't see me drink. You know, and, you know, for a child, it's just okay to say, okay, yeah, cool. You know, but now my child's 13, so last year I started bringing him to the Wednesday night meeting so that he could sit on the side because it's an open meeting where nursing students come and listen in on the meeting sometimes. So I figured it would be pretty good for him to just stay on the side and, you know, just get a little bit of the background, but also to learn a little bit more about me and what is actually I've been through. And hopefully he'll pick something from it. He'll glean something from it like I did when I was sentenced to AA, you know, but that he'll hear something. And I wondered one time if he was listening and I started talking about something on the ride home and he corrected me. He heard every word. He could repeat everything everybody said. You know, he doesn't do very well in the anonymous thing. He outed someone in a restaurant, not knowing. But so we have a little talk about the anonymity thing, that if you see somebody, you can't say, hey, do you go to AA? I thought I saw you at AA. My dad goes to AA. Because his dad doesn't care about whether, who knows where I go to AA, but that other people might. You know, but that's the thing. He has no stigma about it. You know, he has no understanding, you know, the full understanding of it yet. Yeah. And that's one of the things that I'm absolutely blessed with as well. When I talk about absurdities, I was so fortunate to try and get sober in 1991, because it actually had become hip to get sober. You know, I remember the meetings at the club, they were packed. It was something to be in AA, you know, and I know that it still is. But up until then, you know, I mean, there was a stigma attached to it. And the thing is, and this goes back to, I remember one day I was standing in my driveway, and me and my ex-wife were having a big argument, and we were really going at it, and I'm trying to get in the car to leave, and she's at the door, and she's screaming at me, and I'm screaming at her, and it's going back and forth, and back and forth, and she quite resented AA, because AA had done what she had tried to do, and she wasn't successful at it, and she didn't really like that I had this new group of friends that I was with, and that I was really close with these people, and it was somewhere that she couldn't really go, you know, or that I was able to go there without her, you know. And we were arguing, and we were going at it pretty heavy, and that's a judgment of her. But what I'm saying is that when I got sober, the relationship didn't work anymore. We tried to make it work, and after a while, it just didn't work anymore. And as I was screaming at her in the driveway, I screamed at her, you don't understand me. And before I even finished the sentence, as it was coming out of my mouth, I realized, how could she? I didn't understand me. How the hell could she understand me? Yeah. I mean, that's what this was about for me when I got to AA. I didn't understand me. I didn't understand what I was thinking. Yeah. I didn't understand the concept that if you tell somebody something and then you don't follow through with it, that makes you a liar. Yeah. I mean, I didn't understand it. I didn't understand that people weren't going to look at me and think, oh, he has such wonderful intentions. Yeah. And that life wasn't about intentions, and it wasn't about what was going on in my head. And that this poor woman couldn't understand me because she believed all the crap that came out of my mouth. And that's why she didn't understand me. Because my story always changed. You know? And that this time it's going to be different. This time we're going to try this, and this time we're going to do that. Well, how the hell can anybody understand what's going on in someone else's head? You know? But the one thing was, is she always made that mistake of believing in me. She believed me and believed in me. And that's why she didn't understand me. Because I was incapable of being sincere. Because I was incapable of being honest. I didn't know I was incapable of being honest because I didn't know the truth. And that's why I was incapable of being honest. A lot of the things that I said, I absolutely meant them when I said them. You know? But it's kind of like the thought of the day. You know? And today I'm really behind this idea. You know? And tomorrow I'm really behind another idea. And it's like, yeah, but what was the deal with yesterday's? Oh, we've moved on from that. You know? And that's the thing, was the idea of telling her that she didn't understand me. And that's when I realized that I really had no idea who I was. I didn't. I had no idea who I was. Because not only did she believe me, but I believed me. And that's when I realized just how wacky I had become. Going from thought to thought to thought, because my thought processes were out of control. I was really blessed when I went to the club. When I left Charter Hospital in Buffalo, I went down the street and I went to the club over on Columbus Drive. Because that's what they do when you get out of treatment. They tell you, okay, thank you. We appreciate your business. Now please go to AA. You know? And that's what I did. I went to AA. And I remember walking in the big room over at the club and thinking, wow, this place is great. And then looking around and going, wow, this room's green. I'm going to die in this ugly green room. Spend the rest of my life here in this ugly green room. Because I couldn't see what it was going to bring for me. And then I started going to the 545, and I asked the guy in the room to be my sponsor, who irritated me the most. I couldn't stand him. Every time he opened his mouth, I would think, shut up. And the problem was, is he used to talk in this monotone southern drawl. And the real problem was, is that he had peace. And when he spoke, he was peaceful. And the things that he said, they weren't monotone, they were calm. And he could not talk as fast as the racetrack was in my head. So while he was talking in his nice, calm southern drawl, I had already gone 10 places. Yeah. And that's when I realized that he had something I really, desperately wanted. And we had nothing in common. I was 26, he was 63. He was born in Turkey Creek, Florida, he used to say. I mean, it's Plant City. But Turkey Creek, Florida, and then he spent his time in Mobile, Alabama. Yeah, and I grew up in Sharon, Massachusetts. Yeah. And he did not think he was as smart as I thought I was. He was a humble man. He was a wonderful man. His name was Larry O. I'm at the club, and he was my sponsor basically for the first 6 years of my sobriety. And he's the man who took me through the steps, and he's the man that walked me through this book. And my first home group was called the High Noon Big Book at the club at the time. And that's the meeting that Larry and I went through. And I met some really great people at the club and did a whole lot of step work with a lot of people over there. There were a few big book thumpers over there that I started running with. And really got into the book and started doing step studies and working with people. And then, like, on Saturday afternoons, we'd do fourth step studies and everything. And we really got into it. And then sometime around 6 years sober or so, I decided that I had basically tired of AA. Yeah, that you really had begun to. I think what had happened was, is I had gotten divorced, and I think I was just horny. And I decided I wanted to get into a relationship. And I didn't want anybody who had ever even been to an AA meeting, you know. And so I met a girl who had nothing to do with AA. And I used to have a group of friends that I ran with, and all they ever talked about was program. And I was programmed to death. I got so tired of hearing, are you taking my inventory? You know, hey, did you see this movie last night? No, I didn't see it because I didn't think that was good for my program. And I got so tired of hearing it. And I said, you know what, I'm just going to back away from this AA thing for a little while. And I met a girl who had nothing to do with the program. And then I had gone from going to a meeting a week, to a meeting every 2 weeks, to a meeting every month, to one meeting in 6 months, and then just not going at all. And I stayed away from AA, and I stayed away from AA for a period of about 10 years. And I didn't take a drink. But I became exactly the same person I was when I walked through the doors at Charter Hospital. And now, as I had become completely out of control, my thought processes were crazy. I couldn't keep a thought together. My mind was constantly running. And what I found was that I've heard it called that we develop a default position. And I heard it called old behavior. I say, oh, that's your old behavior. And I used to think, no, that's not my old behavior. That's the way I behave. That's my behavior. You know? And the one thing was, is I remember my, Dan calls it his default, the default. And my default before I got to AA was total selfishness. That's where I go first. That's where whenever I'm threatened, whenever you do anything to me, I immediately go into what is in it for me, and how is this going to affect me, and what are you doing, and what are you going to take from me, and oh, will you all just stop pulling on me today? Everybody wants something from me. You know, that was my default position. And for me, what the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous did for me was they changed my default position. where I was able to think of others. Not always first, but I was at least able to think of others. And my default position became asking God for help. That's what the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous did for me, was they taught me how to take a pause and ask for help. When I stopped going to meetings, I stopped getting new ideas on sobriety. I stopped getting new ideas on God. I stopped thinking of God. And my default position became, once again, how is this affecting me? What are you doing to me? Who wants what from me? Can't you all see how difficult this is for me? And I think that's something that's happened to me a couple of times in my life. And what happens is the closer you are to me, the less patience and tolerance I give you. Because I expect you not to say stupid things. And when you say something that might be a little off kilter, I think, what an odd thing to do. And I don't have a problem telling you that. I lose the ability to see your point of view. That's what happens to me when I'm not praying, when I'm not in touch with God. And when I got away from AA, that's what happened to me, was I lost the ability to see other people's point of view, and I can only see what you're taking from me. Yeah. And when I first came back to the program 10 years later, that's what I was doing at meetings. I could only see what I could take from the meeting. It was just a big grab. I've got to get what's mine. I've got to get what's mine, because my default position had gone where it used to be, which was total selfishness. Yeah. And I learned, actually, that it was such a shame that I had stopped participating in my own sobriety, because everything that I've accomplished since March the 5th, 1991, every good relationship that's ever happened in my life, every good thing that's happened to me, having a 13-year-old son, is a benefit from Alcoholics Anonymous. I shouldn't have any of it. I was a 26-year-old kid who wanted to die. I mean, the fact of the matter is, I married my first wife when I was 25, and the only reason why I married her was because I didn't think I was going to live very long. I didn't. I thought I was going to be dead by the time I'm 30, and she wants to get married, and she's put up with me this long, bless her heart, what the hell, I'll marry her. And so I did. Yeah. And that stuff's just absurd. It's just absurd thinking. Yeah. And then, you know, the stuff that happened to me while I wasn't drinking, I mean, it's just a small miracle that I didn't drink. But I'll tell you what, the feelings that I went through and everything were just awful. They were the same. They were the same. I had become suicidal once again. Yeah. And one of the things that I've found to be true in my life is that, and I say this, once you've been suicidal, you never forget what it was like. Yeah. You never forget. Or at least I never forgot. You know, I never forgot that it was that low. Because quite honestly, before I had panic and anxiety attacks or anything like that, I couldn't relate to it. You could watch Oprah and see people talk about it and everything, but I had no idea what they were talking about. You know, no idea whatsoever. You know? And we were talking about this just last night, and that the great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effectual spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. That's what the 12 steps gave to me. They changed my default position. They've revolutionized the way I think. And that is, I can see things from your point of view. Sometimes not always first. Sometimes it's not the first thing I think of. Sometimes I immediately want to get defensive. You know? But that happens less and less and less and less. You know? And the idea that today I can contribute in your life, that was something to me that was just completely foreign when I walked in the door here, because I really just didn't care about you. I really just didn't care. I mean, one of the things I'm doing right now, I work a lot and I spread myself a little bit thin, you know. But I want to be there and answer the phone when you call. You know, I've got the phone numbers tonight. I sponsor guys. I work with guys. I work on the steps, which is something that I hadn't done in years and years and years. Because to be able to say to my son, you know, that I'm an alcoholic and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is what we do for each other. Yeah. That this is what comes with that. You know, and as he gets older, that, you know what, I figured out that him sitting on the sideline, and somebody said it at last night's meeting, And that was, it's just a good way of life. That they're just wonderful life lessons, whether you drink or not. This style of life and this design for living, it just works, right? It's a design for living that works. Yeah, and the idea that we could all be better people, and it was actually a nursing student who said it last night, and she said, you know, this thing that you guys have been talking about, it's not just for alcoholics. It seems like it's a pretty good way to live. You know, and she proved that she had been listening and she had been paying attention. You know, and when I asked my son, he proved to me that he had been listening and he's paying attention. You know, because I've developed a little bit of a different attitude towards my son right now. And that was, I look back on my father and the way that I was raised, and I have a little bit different opinion as to what my responsibility is to my son. I think my responsibility to my son now is to prepare him for a relationship with the God that I understand. And I think that my father and me and my son all share the same father. I mean, I'll get into my own personal religious view right now, and I think we all have one wonderful universal father, and we address him as our father to prove it. Yeah, you know, and that he loves with a father's love. And when my father said to me, I've waited 12 years, I can wait another 45 minutes, I can begin to comprehend what the love of a father is like and how I feel about my son. And I can't imagine my son ever coming to me and saying, Father, I need help. And me saying, no, you go away. You know? And the idea that we have our Heavenly Father, and that's the relationship he has with us, because I know every time I've ever gone to him and said, Father, I need help, that it's been there. It was me that wasn't doing my part. You know? In the church, they used to say, you hear frequently, and they'll say, God be with you. Well, it's absurd. God is with you. And God was always with me. It's me that wasn't doing my part. It goes back to the footprints prayer. For me, that was true. You know, as long as I think I'm doing it on my own, and that's one of the ways I used to be, and I try to avoid being today, and that is the successes are mine and the failures are ours. You know, and it just doesn't work that way. I've been blessed with incredible abundance. I've been blessed with a wonderful wife. I've been blessed with a wonderful ex-wife. I've been blessed with a wonderful son. You know, I have a great life today. I wouldn't have any of it if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I was in Charter Hospital, I was in there with a 76-year-old man. And the 76-year-old man was in there because he was addicted to Nicorette gum. He could not quit Nicorette gum. He had 35 years sobriety, but could not quit Nicorette gum. Now, it's funny how God puts people in your life, and he was 76, and I was 26, actually, at the time. And I remember he said to me, and I used to pull him aside and we used to have little talks. And he said to me, here's the deal. God didn't promise you a rose garden. But God did promise you that if you're willing to do the work and till the soil and plant the seeds, that you can build a rose garden. That's the deal. You know? And it's something I just always hung on to. You know what? It's me that needs to do my part. You know? And that, it's not just so simple as, you know what, it's time to grow up. But for me, it was time to grow up. And it was time for me to, I mean, I'm so blessed that I didn't have a son until I was 35 years old. I had a chance to grow up before I had my son. I watched a brother go through it, and he was trying to grow up at the same time his daughter was. You know? I mean, I've had some really, really good things happen in my life. All of them today spring for Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's no way that I would be alive. There's no way. There's just no way. Because I didn't want to be 22 years ago. I didn't want to be alive anymore. You know? But I had this nagging thing in the back of my head. I had this nagging thing hitting on me. And it was just, you're not done yet. You're just not done yet. You're not done yet. You've got things left to do. You know? It was a great source of my anxiety because I was living a life that I know was not pleasing to whatever God I believed in. I knew I was doing wrong stuff. I knew I was doing. I knew I was hurting myself. And I had this thing in my head saying, you're not done yet, you're not done yet, you're not done yet. And then I got later into the big book and it says, deep inside every man and woman is the fundamental idea of God. Yeah. And for me, what happens to me is when I ignore the fundamental idea of God, when I ignore that little voice inside of me, I've always known the difference between right and wrong. I've always known the difference. People didn't have to tell me the difference between right and wrong. For me, I could feel it. I feel the difference between right and wrong. I know when I'm doing something is right, and I know if what I'm doing something is wrong. And what happens with me is when I do things that I know are wrong, things turn to crap. That's the way it's always gone. And when I do things that I know are right, my day goes much, much better. You know, it's not a matter of all the lights are green all of a sudden. It's that the red lights don't bother me. You know, and that's what happens is when I'm living, I begin to understand in my sobriety the idea of harmony. You know. And the idea of harmony today is that if I'm doing what I should be doing, if I'm living a good life and I'm doing, if I'm answering the voice in my head that's telling me this is right, then I have harmony, I have peace. And when I do the things when I hear in my voice that say, yeah, you shouldn't do that, then I struggle. Yeah. And some days I choose to struggle. Yeah. Don't know why. But some days I still choose to struggle. But the amount of times that I struggle and the number of days I struggle are not nearly as bad as they used to be, and not nearly as many. Yeah, and that's another thing that has been given to me through a process of doing the 12 steps. I went through a second divorce a couple of years ago, and it was funny, right when my marriage was breaking up, a group of guys that I hang out with all started doing a 12-step study. And every day, every week when we meet, my marriage would be worse every week. And every week I felt better. And as I was going through this divorce, I'm going in and I'm talking to these guys. And my personal life on the outside of AA is falling apart. And I'm getting stronger every day. And these guys helped me through the hardest thing I've ever gone through in sobriety. Not only did they help me through it, and they didn't even know they were doing it because I didn't throw it on the table. They didn't even know. But I went in there and I was able to go through the 12 steps once again and take a look at myself and see what my part was in it and face what was my part in it and see that, and in the end of it going, wow, and came out of it in the end, not knowing myself better. Having a better relationship with God and realized that I was walking away and now I was walking back in and I was opening back up. And that's when I started telling people, like this kid who walked into our meeting and he said, hi, my name's John and I'm new to town and I need to find a sponsor. And then I said, my name's Eric. Nice to meet you, John. I'm your sponsor. Yeah. Because I knew I had to get involved. I had to get involved with people. I had to start doing this thing with other people because that's the way it works. Yeah, and I had to be available, you know, so that if you decide to call me Johnny, I'll answer the phone. I'll see your name on the phone and I'll see Johnny. I might be in the middle of something with someone and can't talk right this second, but you'll get a call back from me very quickly, you know. I mean, that's one of the things I try to do. I don't answer Dan's calls, you know. And it's funny because Dan's one of those guys who just, when I first met him, he just irritated me. You know, and one of the reasons why Dan irritates me is because I used to think it's because my shortcomings see your shortcomings. You know, but now I think part of it is more or less the good things in my life I see are the same good things in your life. One of the reasons why you irritated me was because you're too much like me. You're just too much like me. And more Dan and I could spend 6 or 8 hours just talking and talking and talking. And we have a wonderful rapport of debate, and to say you're not seeing this quite correctly, and we're both looking at exactly the same thing from the same angle, we're just using different words. Yeah, so that's one of the things that's happened. It's one of the things that's happened in the last couple of years in my life. I met Keith. Yeah, and there's no reason we should have ever met, brother, none whatsoever, but yet you know things about me that no one else in this room does, you know. And I know things about you as soon as you say, hi, my name's Keith, and I'm an alcoholic. I know things about you that no one will ever know. I know how you feel. You know? So I appreciate your time, and I appreciate you guys letting me speak tonight.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.